Hello, and welcome to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where authors from around the world share how they hope to inspire fellow writers and readers to believe in themselves and others every Tuesday at 1 p.m. on KVSH 101.9 FM and every day at marchtwisdale.com as a podcast. I'm your host, March Twisdale, and I thank you for joining us today. All right, Michelle, so we are live, and let's see here. Okay, everyone, I have actually spent, what is it? I think it's been about a month and a half since we first connected. All of that time being so excited because you are literally one of my favorite authors, which you already know. But I'm just really grateful that you are willing to take the time to call in from Eastern Canada to chat with me today. Thank you for calling in. And so, well, let's talk about your name really quick.
One of the publishers, when they were reprinting the old Del Rey titles, wanted to use Michelle West. And I had said, really, use Michelle Segarra. It's going to be more appropriate. And so then they decided to do Michelle Segarra West, a name I have never used.
Oh, no. Okay. So I've been reading you since I was in my late high school, early college years. And so I've spent years being a little confused by the Segarra, Segarra West, and the West. So here's the great thing is if you discover her work and you haven't read it before and you fall in love with it, you have 39 amazing books ahead of you that you get to enjoy. Let's see here then. So quick intro, would you say you write high fantasy?
Yes, actually. I might say the West novels I would consider high fantasy. The Segarra novels I consider secondary world fantasy.
Would you
tonal difference.
Yeah. Would you be willing to actually explain a little bit about that difference?
I consider, and this is entirely my consideration for it. If people ask, I'll say secondary world fantasy. Mm-hmm. The Michelle Segarra books, especially the Caste novels, very often go on people's lists as urban fantasy.
Oh.
And then there are some arguments. People have arguments about them. But they call them urban fantasy because tonally, they would be urban fantasy. In terms of the way the main character talks and the viewpoint, the tone of the observations.
Oh, I could see how someone could make that argument. Say high fantasy is supposed to have like a bunch of interesting terms, like maybe, you know, the Elfstones of Shannara or something has a lot of really unique terms.
High fantasy, it's not so much that. I would say that high fantasy tends towards elements of the mythic or mythic archetypes. It's in the tone or the voice of the book.
So interesting. I love this. Every time I talk to an author, I learn more. Okay. So folks, let's see. Let me take a look here. So I'm holding this beautiful book in my hands. I'm so happy because it hasn't come out yet and I have a copy in my hands. It releases, what is it, the 29th of this month, correct?
I believe it's 29th.
Yeah. No, I believe so too. In the beginning, of course, it has the list. So the Chronicles of Elantra?
Elantra is what I say, but it doesn't really matter all that much.
When did you first publish Cast in Shadow? I'm looking for like the age or the year span of this series. I'm putting you on the spot.
Well, no, I just have to go look it up. I'm just going off to the website right now. I have to admit that I tend to really focus on the book that is destroying my life now,
right.
i.e. the book that I'm writing, because the books that I have finished are now no longer my problem. I don't have to fix anything. I can't fix anything. I can't change anything.
Therefore,
it's the stuff that I'm revising, writing, beating my head against a wall about.
Yes. Oh, I totally get that. Yeah.
2005.
Oh, you've been doing it closer than a year then. Back to the urban fiction piece. I could see how Kaylin Nea's adventures in all this could almost resemble, you know, a detective or something.
Yes, that's what they are in some ways.
Okay. And that's why urban fiction comes to mind for some people.
No, it's the tone. It is the way that she talks. She tends to talk in a very modern way, or a very modern contemporary way. Therefore, they tend to feel a lot more modern because it's just the dialogue. It's the way she talks.
And right. And even when she's engaging with the Barani and the dragons and all these different people, they might have their fancy ways of doing it, but she just brings that street smart type of attitude forward.
Yes, in some ways, although I will tell you a funny story. So Harlequin has a house rule, rules for punctuation, house rules for spellings, house rules for other things.
Right.
One of their house rules is no semicolons in dialogue. And so I was told about this, although I was also told that the editor in question had said, leave her semicolons alone. And I thought, well, what kind of an idiot put semicolons in dialogue? And as I discovered, the answer is me. I am that idiot. But I've been thinking about Kaylin and the break in the way she talks, mm-hmm. and not about my dragons or my Brani or my scholars or my other people, all of whom speak with semicolons. It was just, I don't think about the punctuation. Semicolons, I mean, I will probably remove 2/3 of the natural semicolons that I tend to write into the books. Semicolons for me, mm-hmm. are a natural part of the way I think and write. Mm-hmm. Some people find them pretentious, or some people don't like them very much, but...
Oh my gosh, wow, like it would never even occur. Pretentious implies judgment. I couldn't even imagine going to that type of a place, but...
Mm. Oh, no, no. No, no, I have certainly had people talk
How
about
is a semicolon pretentious? It's basically a form, if you think about it, a comma really is a pause for breath. So a semicolon, yes. For me, it's like as a person, just when you think, like everyone out there who's listening right now, just think about how you communicate. You know, some of us paraphrase, some of us preface and then say what we mean to say. Some of us sandwich, you know, we're going to throw a compliment in and then we're going to put in something else followed by compliment. All of these are ways in which people get the what's going on inside their brain through this thing called a mouth into someone's ears to land in their brain to hopefully reflect to some degree what was in the original brain that it came out of. I mean, this is what language is about. So a semicolon to me would simply be like a type of a breath or a type of a framing of the language. So I'm surprised anyone would have an opinion one way or the other.
Well, nobody sees semicolons or commas when you're speaking, right?
Right, but we start not getting rid of commas.
No, we are not, but commas are not considered. I don't know. I have no idea why I use them.
I started off with the Sun Sword series, I believe is the title. The Broken Crown is the first book, I think.
Yes.
Okay. And then there's the House War series.
Which follows on from the Sun Sword.
Right.
Sort of.
And okay, so I'm going to bounce a little bit here because I went into Twitter and I mentioned in the writing community, which is a really... can be an incredibly warm and welcoming community. And I'm actually asked, I said, hey, you know, like I'm interviewing this amazing author. And is there anyone out there who loves her like I do? And you have a question you want me to ask? I thought, oh, I'll just throw that out there. And so this woman responded and I couldn't tell what she was talking about. So I had to ask because, and this is actually, and now I know, but it's so cool. But she said, do you ever ship or not ship the relationships in your books? What was your favorite canon ship? What was your favorite ship that didn't happen? Were there any ships you hated? And I'm like, I'm seeing sailboats, okay? I was like, hey, and this other woman, she's like, I'm seeing packages being shipped around. Like, what is this woman talking about? And apparently that means like it's short for relationship.
It sort of is, but yeah. It's a colloquialism. It sort of is. Like, for instance, people will say, I'm shipping X or Y. And they'll say, okay, my ship has sailed. And it still means the same thing. The ship sailing means that the relationship that they wanted is happening.
Let's just dive into that, actually, because honestly, I like bad boys sometimes. And this other woman on Twitter, she said, how did she put it? She wanted more Lord Nightshade. And then there's the demon in the Sun Sword series who was like the sort of the father figure to the girl demon.
It's Isildur.
Oh, okay. So honestly, you have all these really amazing potential dark romance things that sometimes happen, sometimes don't happen. How does that work on your end? Big question. Sorry.
It's not really a big question, but I will say up front that one of the things that I cannot quite figure out how to add to a book is romance. My own particular worldview, maybe, I don't know. I have read romances. I have tried to absorb what they have. But the actual structure of romance or romantic interactions, I have not absorbed it in a way that allows me to believe it enough to write it.
Oh, honey, we believe for you.
Yes, but what that actually means is I generally tend to let the interactions between characters be what they are. I don't have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can. There were people who were quite upset at me with Hunter's death because they had very strong relationship vibes from one of the main characters, Jewel, mm-hmm. and Devon Aterifin. But I mean, he's twice her age. So was he protective? Yes. In some ways, on some level, she is like a child to him.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that that would somehow become a relationship did not occur to me. It did occur to many people, and some of them were not happy. But it hadn't occurred to me as a writer.
Right. So, I remember that. Yeah. I've never been a romance reader. There was one book by a woman named, I think, Beatrice Small, if I'm getting the author's name right, called The Kadin, K-A-D-I-N. And it is about as non-romancy as a romancy book can sort of get. And I read that when I was in high school. And I like literally carried that book with me. Like I moved a lot. And it was this one of like, you know, 19 books that always was in a box moving with me. And that was the only technically romance book that I had ever read for like almost forever until recently. Jennifer Armentrout, who I believe technically is writing romance, she came out with some YA, also fantasy novels that have a romance edge to them, but I'm just really big into the worlds. So I don't have any expertise in this area, but it's the potentiality that is super exciting. And the possibility that maybe something's going to come of it. So when you think of Lord Nightshade, you know, you do a great job, whether it's intentional or it's just natural for the characters, of there being this edginess of this potentiality that obviously other readers are picking up on too. And then at the same time, you're thinking that would actually be really inappropriate, potentially, or not healthy for Kaylin. And yet, just the fact that it's a possibility, there's something about it that's very intriguing. So I don't know.
But see, now at the heart of what you're talking about here, that's where the shippers are,
mm-hmm.
right? They're looking at it and they're thinking, okay, I want more of this. I want more of this. It is not deliberate on my part.
Are you one of the writers who feels like they create their own life and that you're co-creating with them?
I will say this. One of those things that's always very difficult. Let me go back to the question of process, because everybody's process is somewhat individual.
Yes.
I think you have to sit down and I think you have to write your books. And I think you write the books that are yours to write. And how you get to those books is entirely individual. However, for me, I have never understood the question, what's more important, character or plot? Because you cannot have plot without character. Mm-hmm. You just cannot do it. So the characters are very defining. I have a rough idea of who they are. And I have a rough idea of what they're going to do. Do you know those situations in which you have two best friends, right? They're people that you adore, you trust them, they know your history, you have history with them. And you're really, really looking forward to introducing them to each other because you're certain they will love each other. And it's not that you don't know who they are, because you've known them forever. So you do know them. And then you put them in a room together and they hate each other's guts out. They just instant antagonism.
Oh,
and
no.
You're left kind of thinking, what happened? What did I, but you know, because you do know them. It's just that you don't know how their interaction will go until they're put in a room together.
Right.
And that's Michelle and writing. there are people who have scenes with intent. This is what this scene has to accomplish.
Oh,
this is what this scene
point.
Has to invoke or evoke.
Uh-huh.
I have hope. I approach them hopefully. I think, okay, this is what's going to happen. Then I had to tell you 50% of the time or more, it really isn't what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody starts talking and everything goes left.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can either try to pull it back and force it to conform to what you thought it was going to be, or you can just go left. It's the second part of Michelle's writing. End of every book, I knew what it was going to be when I started it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how it was going to get there, but I understood the structures of society and I had the characters. I knew where it had to go. It makes a difference to what you write, because knowing what the end is, you understand the emotional structure that supports the end.
Yes.
But it still didn't mean I knew how it was going to get there.
Right.
It didn't mean that I wasn't screaming at my computer screen in outrage and terror when somebody did something that was so totally unpredictable to me. But oddly enough, this one particular thing that was really stressing me out, even after the book was finished, my editor said, "Michelle, that is kind of character definitional." And I said, "But he's been so smart till now." And she said, "Okay, you know, in that writers are writers." She had no problems with it. It didn't seem out of character at all, but it had seemed out of character to me writing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it was what that character was going to do. There was nothing that I could do short of chopping the entire scene off and again, forcing it, that was going to change that. And I generally tend, if I have a choice, I'll go with the character.
So let me ask that a little bit, because you speak often in your books, and I don't even know the term for it, I don't know, the acknowledgments, you know, in the beginning where you're like thanking people who support you and all this, you know, you acknowledge with the same humor that you just showed in the last minute, you know, that there's this agonizing, you know, despairing side to this work that you do. What is it that you love about what you do that makes it possible to keep going in spite of the massive, all the agonies?
To be honest, that me screaming at the computer screen is happening after. There is a place in which it's almost like you have to rush to keep up with the story flow.
Uh-huh.
Something has broken through, and all of a sudden, you are right in the book. You don't struggle. You're not struggling with the words. The words are the words that embrace that tone or that place. It is, I love that. I love it when I hit my stride or I hit that flow. Writers describe it in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
There is a joy and an intensity in it that I have in almost nothing else. So I love writing when it is going well. However, to finish a book, you are going to get a whole crap load of times when the book is not going well. If you're not willing to wade through the wrong turns and the things not going well, then the things going well don't matter.
Right.
Because they're incomplete.
Right, like someone who is, you know, plays professional football. There's all the stuff that they love about it, but they also have to accept they're going to get, you know, thrown on their butt, and they might break a few bones along the way, be sore.
They're going to lose games.
Yep. Maybe get concussions.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it enough that I'm willing to soldier through all the times when it is not going well. I actually love parts of writing an enormous amount. And when it goes well, I'll say something funny. If when I'm writing, I am weeping, it's something that always, always works on the page.
Yeah.
I have never, ever had to change anything. It is embarrassing, on the other hand. Like when I was writing Grave, where I'm sitting in the coffee shop, because at the coffee shop, if the phone rings, it's not my problem. If a child is crying, it's not my problem. If a child throws up on the ground, I don't have to clean it up. It is, none of it is my problem. And there was one session of 2 hours, I swear to God, that I was weeping. I'm sure that people thought, looking at me, that I was, you know, answering divorce emails or something. Because I really had to actually, a number of times, just wipe the tears away so I could read the screen.
And everyone's tiptoeing around. They're like, oh, God, what, you know, who died? This poor woman.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that. But I also knew that those words would not have to change.
Mm-hmm. So and you were not getting up from that chair.
No, because I was in the middle. I was right in the flow of it. But enough, the character viewpoint, and I tend to write in character viewpoint, is strong enough that you are exactly where you need to be to write this section. But it's not even that intellectual. You just start, usually it's a phrase.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, the character is trying to convince somebody that his guilt is pointless. Because if he could somehow go back in time, to change everything. If he'd not, to even face off, to fight, he'd be dead, which is true. And then she says, which I hadn't expected, all I would have had to do is make one phone call. And then it just goes on from there. With death, there's grief. And then sometimes in certain things, there's guilt. And for her, the boyfriend died in a car accident when he was driving to her house.
This is, Grace is kind of it's like the Queen of the Dead trilogy. Yeah.
Right. It's and this is something that she says in the third book. Was I planning to have her say that? No, it's just that she did. When she was talking to somebody else about their guilt, she then closes it with, all I had to do was make one phone call. And then we just go on from there. But you're right. It's the unexpected, unplanned, perfect cry from the interior of where your character is. That's where you are. And so those words, I don't know. But I can doubt every other word. And when I'm, after I've done my first draft, it's me going back to look at the sentences and thinking, oh my God, who let the drunk monkeys loose?
Like the drunk monkeys. There's the creative, artistic side of writing. And then there is the editing side. And then there's the platform business side. And then there's the survive and don't give up side. And the sides just sort of go on. One thing I want to ask about, Anne McCaffrey wrote a similar number of books. And even if they were in the same world, because they were their own trilogy, it was perhaps a little bit easier to really make sure that everything stayed tight within the story. And from book one to two to three, you didn't lose things. You, like, for example, with the Cast series, that's a lot of books in that series. You're having to hold together. I mean, you need book number 16 to not make something in book number three suddenly sound illogical or something. Just for the sake of sharing your own way of doing it, because it might work for someone else. Not, I know, because you're telling people how to do it, because everyone's process is different. But what works for you when it comes to organizing all these details so that you can both access them and also, when something comes up in your mind, you go, oh, yes, you even know where to, like, put that. Like, how what do you use for organizing all that information?
I have a wiki. Like, it's not a online wiki, but it's a personal wiki. And I tend to add information that I'm probably sure I'm going to forget, like eye colors.
Right.
Onto the wiki. I'm terrible with people's eye colors, unless the eye colors are significant. So it's easier in the Cast novels, because most races have eye colors that respond to emotional state. But even then, the colors are different depending on the race, and humans don't. And then sometimes has beard or not. And I had a timeline, which I don't have in the Caelan books. There's a very different organizational structure for the West books than there is for the Cast books. The Cast books, in theory, were supposed to be able to sort of stand alone. They're sort of more episodic.
Yeah,
so
like
a police officer.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Like a detective series where maybe you could do the whole thing from beginning to end, but if you just pop in and grab one, it's going to work.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in fact, that's not apparently entirely true. That was my intent, but it is very hard for any writer to see whether or not it works, because you know all the information.
Yeah.
Reading it. Some of the things that you just take totally for granted might be information that new readers don't have. If people get lost in something, they probably aren't going to continue. So it is a tricky balance. And so Cast in Sorrow is the only book where somebody actually, one of the reader comments was, you know, best exposition ever. And it is basically an internal monologue of a rant. Caelan's rant to her past self. Do not do this. Oh, and if you see this, don't do this.
Oh, that's a really cute little way of doing it.
Yeah, it was perfect, actually, for the person that Caelan was. It was just, as I said, I woke up and thought, oh my God, why are you struggling with this? You know exactly what to do, because Caelan is pretty chatty on the inside of her head. On the other hand, I wrote a novel about Severn. The first is The Emperor's Wolves.
Well, there's another one still coming out, right? You haven't finished
it? There is a second one. That's the one I'm working on now.
Okay.
But I got to tell you, everybody around me got to hear me bitterly complain about the fact that Severn does not talk.
Oh, yeah.
He's a totally different character type, and he is not talking.
And now he's your main character?
Well, It is his story, but in fact, it is multiple point of view because Severin doesn't talk.
He was very, very communicative as a foil to, yes, he spoke in volumes by what he didn't say or what he didn't respond to or whatever. And yeah, if you take away his person to be quietly responding to, then what do you do?
Yeah, it was great. It was a lot of hair-pulling moments. Why? Why?
Are you
So
happy in
it's.
the end?
Oh, well, was I fine with it in the end? Yes, I was absolutely fine with it in the end. But it's
Okay.
the first one of the Cass novels that has been multi-viewpoint because it is
Yeah.
some of it is Severn, some of it is Ibeline, some of it is the Wolf Lord, some of it is Illuvian. So the viewpoint does shift
And how was
because
that for you? Because I don't.
that was fun. It's
You.
fine. I actually like multiple viewpoints better.
Okay. Well,
I
I
find
mean,
them.
House War. Isn't that multiple viewpoints?
All of the West novels were.
Okay. I
All of
was
the
like,
West novels have
yeah. Okay.
always had multiple viewpoints. I prefer it in a lot of ways because a multiple viewpoint book allows you to get the story across without feeling the necessity to warp the plot so that the main character is always in the place where you need to have information come from.
Or everything
So
is, I mean,
instead of
through their viewpoint as well. I mean, right? You know, it's like if everything is through their view, then it's their view is always coloring absolutely everything. You never actually get a 100% access to the other character because it's always the POV's
Well,
point
yeah,
of
but
view.
that's always going to be true. It's just that I didn't have to have a 16-year-old street urchin with no political connections being the only funnel for action. Because there's no way she can be everywhere. There's no way she'd be allowed to be everywhere. So the book can naturally evolve and the story can evolve so the readers know more than the individual characters, but they get the whole picture from the differing viewpoints.
Right.
And if you only have one viewpoint, you either just drop things, well, things were happening in the background, but you're never seeing it. Or you somehow have to try to warp plot so that that person is in a location they couldn't naturally be,
Or they're
which.
hearing about it after the fact or whatever. Yeah, and it can work beautifully and wonderfully. Clearly it can, but you're right. It's an in a way it's a limiting factor.
Yes, it's a limiting factor that multiple viewpoints get rid of.
Yeah.
You have to actually believe what you're writing. Okay, no, I have to actually believe what I'm writing. Let me not try to generalize for everybody.
Yeah, I hear
I
ya.
assume that it is true for everybody, but I have to believe it. And if I have to put a character in a place that strains my ability to believe that this could happen, it's just not going to work. Even if other people can make it work quite well, I can't.
Yeah, the alligator
So
in Alaska is just really hard to pull off.
Yes, exactly that. So I tend to prefer multiple viewpoints.
You know, it's
With
interesting, in my novel, The Ghost Lords, which is not yet published, one thing I got from it was the idea of multiple point of view through flash fiction. So it's first person, but scattered throughout are these little tiny flash fiction vignettes that are written in third person from a different point of view. Each character that's important in book one gets their own little flash fiction vignette. And I don't know. I hope it works, but I really felt like it allowed me to expand into things that could not be seen through the point of view of the primary character.
It's one of the reasons I don't love first person as a narrative. It's because it is difficult for the reasons that you've stated, right? These
Yeah.
are important characters and first person, but first person allows you to do other things that are interesting. Like first person is almost by definition an unreliable narrator. People don't generally consider it that way, but it is. So you can do interesting things or different things because of that.
I think you're right. People don't typically align those two. Do you want to go a little bit more into depth about what, for people who are maybe readers out there and haven't heard the term unreliable narrator before, do you want to detail that a bit?
Sure, an unreliable narrator. Usually, when you're reading narrative fiction, what you're reading, you accept as truth for that book. A first person viewpoint is a little bit more intimate, but it's also tied up in all of the assumptions that the narrator makes. So there are misunderstandings. The narrator can feel something very strongly, and it will be colored with, say, their pain or their anger or their certainty that they're being somehow attacked or whatever. The reader accepts that up front. However, that is not always the case. All of us have misinterpreted things that have happened. It's like any argument you have with friends where you eventually settle things out and people think, wait, that's what you meant?
Right.
Until that point, the internal narrative absolutely viscerally believes in what they feel and how they personally have interpreted things. So a first-person narrative can be interesting because the type of surprise changes not what actually happened, but can change how readers view it.
Perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's perspective of it.
Mm-hmm. And what would be an example of a reliable narrator?
They're just, you can trust that their observations are true.
Would that typically be third person more often than first person?
No, actually, there are a lot of first person books where the first person is a reliable narrator, right? It's just that, the boundaries of the story can be expanded even with first person narratives when you realize, the moment that you realize that this person who is telling you this is totally misinterpreting, or that you'd look at the events that the first person narrator is talking about and think, if you were talking to a friend, you'd say, I don't think they meant what you think they meant with those words.
What type of power and value do you think you can pull out of that? Like, how would you intentionally have Kaylin misunderstand something? What would be your purpose? Like, I want her to misunderstand this because I want that to come out. What's like an example of how you would intentionally use that?
No. I having said all of that, it's not something that I'm personally, with these books, interested in doing.
Well, okay. I was going to say, I haven't noticed that happening with Kaylin very much.
No, I like it as
okay.
a reader.
Got it.
Because it adds a layer.
Mm-hmm.
But it adds a layer in certain types of stories, or it changes. Like, the minute you have an unreliable narrator, you're changing tone.
Mm-hmm.
The tone becomes the thing that shifts, right? So the voice of the book is not heavily rooted. And the minute that you begin to detect little cracks, it changes the way that you interact with text. So instead of believing everything that this person is telling you, you are now assessing.
Mm-hmm.
You are now thinking, okay, now wait. And you still don't know. But part of the reward of a book like that is, in fact, you building alternate pictures from a book that, in theory, won't offer it.
Right. Gives you creative agency as the reader, in a way.
Yes. Yes.
It's not a concrete
creative.
It's not like you're creating reality.
I wouldn't say that but I would say that the author intends that. So it's not really, it isn't a creative agency per se. It's more like reading a mystery novel.
Yeah.
Where whodunit, where you're now trying to hold all the things in your head so that you can figure out the mystery before the book goes there.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Like, I've never been part of a book club, you know, where readers get together and talk once a month about the book they all read or something. I've always thought that would be super fun, and I've literally never done it. But it just occurred to me, imagine if you were like part of a group of like, you know, 10 people who you all read the same book and get together and chat. If you were reading a mystery, I'll bet when you got together and you were like, well, midway through, who did you think had done it? Like, I'll bet every person's going to have a different idea. Just think about that capacity within the world of a mystery for readers to form their own ideas of whodunit that are not completely controlled and presented to them by the writer. And then at the end, they all come together and they get the answer from the writer. But before that, I bet their imagination was all over the place.
Yes. Imagination is obviously required for fiction, right?
Yeah.
But fiction can point at things that are, I don't know, different than life or larger than life. People can approach things from an entirely different angle. So how do I say this? I don't deliberately write message fiction.
I don't think I would be good at it.
Yeah.
But do you feel like messages come through anyway?
I think sometimes they do. But they do because Kaylin herself, the character herself, is learning things. things that she believed. The third book is possibly the biggest one, where she's spent her entire life in this series up till that point absolutely hating and loathing the mind readers, the Alani mind readers, and people who are basically capable of learning things about you that you don't want, as if those people are going to be attempting to do exactly that. There is a strong fear component to the deep personal loathing. And what she has to do, or what she does, is to reevaluate when she actually meets somebody.
That's true.
And finds out what their lives are like.
Yeah, there was a lot of internal growth for her in that one, for sure. Also, one thing I've noticed is, you know, I'm trying, I guess, what's the duology? What's the name of the duology? Hunter's Oath is like one of the titles, I think.
Sacred Hunt.
Sacred Hunt, there you go. Yeah. So that one focuses largely on male characters. But similar to some of the other writers who I've been drawn to in my life, I think there's an innate empowerment of, wrong word, women. You have a lot of really strong female characters. And I could imagine a person who says, I want to prove to the world that, you know, women can be strong, so therefore I'll set out to do this. Da, 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 da. That's like one way to go about it. But it could just, I mean, I don't know if there's a level of intentionality or just instinct or desire or whatever, but you definitely present brilliant, empowered female characters as well as males. But for women growing up in a patriarchy, reading about women who are capable and succeed, that's important.
How do I put this? I actually had another author friend whose name I will not mention, and she'd read Hunter's Oath and Hunter's Death, and she loved the books, but she actually asked me on the phone, but why are all of your women so bitchy?
Oh.
And I thought, huh? So then I found another author, a mutual author friend, and I said, Alice, are my women bitchy? Right? Like, why are they asking this question?
Right.
This writer said, after a pause, the thing that I have always liked about your female characters is how remarkably free from sentiment they are.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, wait, so that's kind of a yes? And she said, I think that they're exactly what they would be given the power that they have and the responsibility that they have. Possibly that would not be what was expected, but I honestly did not write them in any other way except these are the women who are in charge of everything, judgment, the running of the duchy, the government, because the men don't. But the land is based on the hunter lords, because those are the people who might have to die. So the women rule everything except the hunt and the sacred hunt. And so for me, the responsibilities of rulership and the power are going to create a certain type of character interaction.
Yeah,
I never ever considered it bitchy.
No, and I wouldn't either. No, I agree completely. There's a level of pragmatism when you have responsibility for large communal events. I don't know what, you know, if you're responsible for the kingdom, if you're responsible for the castle, whatever, you know, you have a lot of people underneath you who are looking to you for leadership, direction, security, confidence. They need to know that what they're doing is okay and going to work because you believe in it so strongly. And so that you can't just sit around and, you know, be like, super soft and weepy and insecure and not sure of yourself and expect people to follow you.
Nope. So to me, they were rulers and they did not speak any differently than a ruler would.
Mm-hmm.
But this was when I discovered that there's a strong embedded idea of woman, what woman should be or what feminine woman should be or something that I had not considered when I was creating that particular universe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, so I've interviewed some people who have definitely set out to tackle important issues in the world through their fiction. And I mean, dystopia does that in particular. But I wouldn't say that I get that sense from your books that you're out to, like, you know, make a super big point. It feels to me like you are out to flesh out this world and create this incredible ride for your readers that is worth their time.
I would say the people who are trying to more deliberately make points are also doing the same thing, because you're not going to get people reading something if they do not find it compelling.
Yeah.
It's a more deliberate choice. I mean,
sure. Oh, I wasn't criticizing it. Yeah. No, not at all.
No. But the things that moved me to write these particular books were not that.
Do you know what it is that moved you to write these stories?
Well, I haven't finished the West books yet.
Yeah.
And yes, it's the ending. Mm-hmm. So with The Sacred Hunt, it wasn't the ending, as I discovered to my great sorrow, when I had to go past the point for which these books had been created and still had to finish the book. But the ending is very often, it's a strong emotional response from me. So I have an end in mind, and I know exactly what it feels like.
Was that true for the Sunsword series?
Yes.
So, I guess, where does that ending come from? Like, you know, you're walking along, you're sleeping in bed, you're gardening, I don't know what you're doing, you're pregnant, whatever, and you have this ending that comes.
You
have
a sense of where. Writing. Oh my God.
Well, you know, sorry. What is it that brings endings to mind, maybe would be the question. Like where, because I know, I don't know, maybe it's really hard to answer, in which case we can blow off the question, but it is a question that people oftentimes are curious about, that generative aspect.
For me, the world starts with the Hunter books and the end of Stephen's arc. I don't know if that was, like, I wasn't deliberately thinking, oh, what should I write about? Because that's not the way I work.
Mm-hmm.
But the end of Stephen's arc, I could absolutely see. And so I don't make notes. I don't think, well, maybe I could write a story about this later. I just have that. And then if it persists, it is strong enough for me to carry a book.
Mm-hmm.
People sometimes say, well, you know, don't you write down your ideas? What if you forget about it? And my response is often, if I forget about it, it probably would not carry me through a book.
Yeah. No, very fair. Very fair point. Yes.
But I had something in mind, and I don't know how much of that is coming out of current events or the emotional reaction I've had to reading about some current events, or thinking about how people in actual reality would feel or respond to certain things. But it's just, I had this clarity of emotion and the layers of emotion. And that was the end of Stephen's arc. And then the question was, how do I create an emotional path from the beginning of a book to that point so that other people can maybe, if I do it properly, feel the same thing.
Right.
Poetry to me is an act of speaking in symbols that are recognized to people who read poetry. That the metaphors, if the most striking poetic metaphors for me are the ones that I haven't thought of, but that immediately describe an emotion or an emotional place.
Right.
Fiction for me is forging the path. Right. How do I deliver this sense of emotion and response?
Mm-hmm.
What do I do to build the structural attachments so that when I reach that point, people will experience that emotion?
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. When I started my radio show, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, about 7.5, almost 8 years ago. The reason I started it was because I feel like if we can combine the mind and the heart, it's when you have both that you can get like a real change in a human being. I think the change has to happen emotionally and not just in your mindset. And that was sort of what I wanted to do with the radio show, was bring forward writers of fiction and give them a chance to, you know, speak to that power of emotion to create lasting change and inspire positive social change in the world through stories.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I think about it as social change when I'm working on it. I feel sometimes that it is, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I agree, but in terms of actual intent for me while I'm writing, mm-hmm. that's not it, because I've sort of reached a point where I can do my best to attempt to describe or create mm-hmm. an emotional place, but I'm well aware that people will read into things that I, in their own way, we right. reading is personal. Our emotional responses are personal. I used to believe when I was much younger, and in fact, Broken Crown was the book that broke that, that if I was actually clear enough, then people would love these books, right? No, that's not the way it works. So what I came to understand is that people bring a lot of themselves into fiction. It's why the reactions are often so personal.
Oh, and yes.
I accept that. I can do my best to make clear what I intended in the book, but people are going to pick up things that I didn't intend for them to pick up. That is the way it works. Even if it moves them immensely, not always pick up what I thought.
Yeah, it's a partnership between the writer and the reader, not so much
yes.
feel like it's definitely a partnership, especially books. So movies are less of a partnership because you're providing so much. There's the visuals there, you know, it's so much is put on the screen. I feel like movies are much more controlling of what the viewer is going to get out of them. But books, I don't know. Yeah.
Even in movies, my example is Sense and Sensibility, because it's probably more widely viewed than Freak the Mighty. Mm-hmm. I am watching Sense and Sensibility with my sister for the first time. And I really quite liked it.
Mm-hmm. But which one? It was made at least twice. Which one?
Oh, no, the Hugh Grant one.
Yes. Emma, okay.
Thompson Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
The one that was directed by, I think it was Ang Lee. So I'm watching it with my sister. And at the end, you know, when the youngest sister gets, you know, oh, it's the
older guy who was super cool.
And I said, yeah, that's not the Colonel. No, no, it's that Hugh Grant guy. And she said, Michelle? And I said, because he's on a brown horse. And she said, pardon? And I said, well, did you not notice? And this is me, because I've only seen it once. Well, these horses white except for the tail. And Alan Rickman's horse is black. It's all black. And Hugh Grant's horse is all brown, except for the tail. They used solid color horses, so I assume they did it for a reason. And she was just appalled because I actually, it took me an age to ask her, can we see that Lucy person is doing all this on purpose? And she's like, oh my God, are we even watching the same movie? Of course she's doing it on purpose. But it just, you know, it was not as obvious to me.
The two of you were taking away totally different stuff.
Yes, totally different things. Watching exactly the same movie for the first time, period.
And I love Alan Rickman's character. Oh my God.
Yes, I did. But what I mean is the things that she had expected to surprise me, I'd spoiled because it was, I said, wait, no, but that's a brown horse.
Right.
Or how can you miss that she is deliberately doing this? Didn't you see the way that she looked at this? It's like, well, clearly no. I mean, it hadn't occurred to me. So
in a way, when you're writing your book, you have to remember to let go of expectations or a desire to have control over what the readership is going to think of it to a degree.
Yes. And then, you know, if the readers hate it, boy, they're really going to hate it. No. And part of the problem is fiction engenders emotional response.
Mm.
So if they're going to hit it, man, have you ever thrown a book that you absolutely hated the end of across the room?
You know, I think I've, well, about twice in my life, I've actually been that upset. I'm not much of a thrower, but twice, yes. And then there's the book that I couldn't finish, It by Stephen King. I'll never forget my very conscious decision to, cannot read another page. No. I mean, I'm scarred, and I only got through like the first quarter of that book.
Some people are not for her.
No, not that one. I read other Stephen King. I love The Stand, for example. So why don't we go ahead and pull back around for a second, unfortunately, since we're running out of time, and talk a little bit more about Cast and Conflict, just to make sure people know where, I want everyone who's listening to this interview to know exactly where they can find you. And I want them to have memorized your name. Okay, so everyone, just take the time in your life to check out Michelle's work. And if it is your thing, then you're in for a huge, many, many, many book treat. And if it's not your thing, well, then that's fine too. I'm sorry you're missing out. So Michelle with two L's, that's always important to know. And Sagara is, it's all A's, Sagara. So Cast and Conflict is, just tell me, is this the end? I have no idea. I haven't finished it. Is this the end of the series?
It is not the end. No, it is not the end.
Good. Okay.
With these books, what I actually said when I started them was, I'm just going to write stories until I run out of story ideas that I want to tell, and then I'm going to end it.
Okay.
So I need a few books ahead. But the problem is, and this is consequence, right?
Yeah.
You start and think, I'm going to write a book about the Thalamani. That's book two. Then I'm going to write a book about the Aryans. Oh, actually, no, wait, I can't write a book about the Aryans yet because I have to do this one thing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write a Dragon Court book. There's a whole bunch of things that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But the consequences of some of the decisions that had occurred in previous books changed the shape of the narrative choices. And also some of them I wanted to actually investigate.
Right.
So Cast in Conflict comes out of Cast in Wisdom in a way. And it's because in order to get to the end, there are a couple of things I want from the very underexplored Fifes. Part of that will be addressed mm-hmm. in Cast in Conflict. And part of that will be addressed in the book that follows it.
Well, okay. So wait, it says here on the inside cover, it goes through all of them, Cast in Wisdom. And then this is Cast in Conflict. And then it says, and Cast in Moonlight found in Harvest Moon. I'm confused.
Cast in Moonlight was a novella.
Okay, I remember. Okay, it sounded familiar. Okay.
So if you are a print reader, then you can only find it in the collection, the anthology, or not really anthology, but a collection of three novellas.
Which is Harvest Moon.
One of them. Yes. One of them is Harvest Moon.
Publishers have supported different works. So like House War is not mentioned on the inside of here. So
yes.
So that's why you end up having, they don't cross-reference each other?
They don't, partly because it's a different name, I think, but they're different publishers.
Okay.
And it's a different series.
Got it.
And to be honest, when I first wrote the Cast series, I felt somewhat certain that West readers would not appreciate it because
really?
It's very, very different. Well, yeah. Wow. And I didn't want people to pick up a Sagara novel and expect it to be a West novel because they probably weren't going to be very happy.
Well, that makes sense. I could understand if someone, expectations are a great way to be unhappy in life. But for me, there's a level of wit, and there's a way in which you as a writer describe things that's definitely similar across all of the books.
Some of the readers said exactly that. Mm-hmm. Some of the readers said, well, you're two of my favorite authors, but I would never have guessed you were the same because the books are so different. And so it's what you get out of it as a reader probably changes, or what you're attuned to as a reader will change depending on it.
Yeah.
I had one reader, I had one customer at the store because I work at a bookstore, Bath & Phoenix bookstore in Toronto. And she came in and she picked up Broken Crayon and came to the counter. And I said, Marcia, what are you doing? And she said, well, I really love your other book, so I'm going to read this one. And I said, no, no, you are not going to read that one. Oh. And she looked at me and I said, you don't like multiple viewpoints. You don't like politics or court politics. You don't like armies and battles. I said, everything about the Broken Crayon.
Oh, but you denied her the Broken Crayon.
Well, so she put it back. But then apparently she snuck into the store when I wasn't there and bought it. Uh-huh. But she didn't finish it.
Oh.
Right? She didn't finish it because...
So you nailed it. You were right.
Well, because I'd been recommending books and because I'd been dealing with her for years, I knew what she liked and what she didn't. And this was really what she didn't. So, but it wasn't my fault because I was trying to get her not to buy it.
I know. You're being honest. I'm so grateful that I happen to like every single thing that you've written. So I'm just thrilled that my interest spectrum is broad enough to encompass all the books.
I don't mind. Well, okay. But how do I put this? I don't generally expect that people will love both of them. Mm-hmm. So it's always nice when people do. Mm-hmm. And it tends to be a little bit broader than like you'll read a whole bunch of different things.
Well, if you came out with a Western, I don't think I'd like it.
I have never, I admit, been drawn to writing a Western.
Yeah.
Although when I remember that one of the big famous Westerns that I cannot remember, my dad really liked it, was based on the Seven Samurai, then I think, well, okay, maybe. You can never say never.
No, it's never say never. I know you might be the writer of a Western that I would love. So there we go. Oh, my goodness. All right. So real quick, how do people find you on the internet?
I am M. Sagara, MSAGARA on Twitter. I am at MichelleSagara, one word, .com. That's my website, and it has preview chapters and little cover things. Mm-hmm. And I am on Facebook as Michelle Sagara as well.
Excellent. Michelle Sagara. And so everyone, if you go to my website, marchtwisdale.com, and you take a look at Michelle's interview, which will be under the podcast page, you'll also see that she has a bio there. And we always make sure that the bio includes links to where you can find people online. So if you've just tuned in at the end of this interview and you missed the beginning, you want to go catch it all, that's where you go, marchtwisdale.com. And if you want to see all these beautiful books by Michelle, it's Michelle Sagara. Is that .com?
Yes, it's a .com.
Good. Excellent. And then Twitter would be M. Sagara.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Thank you so much for calling in and Zooming in, I should say, and joining me on Prose, Poetry, and Purpose.
Thank you for inviting me.
Aye.